First Minute Capital is a $100 million seed fund, proudly backed by a number of tech founder LPs, including 30 unicorn founders. Part of our DNA is to take wisdom and lessons learned from one generation of successful entrepreneurs and share those lessons and pieces of advice with the next generation of successful founders. And that's what this webinar series is all about. My First Minute is a fun opportunity to informally speak to some of the world's top founders on their first minute of their career, how they see the world, and general leadership advice. My name is Camilla Mazzolini, and I'm an investor at First Minute Capital. And today I'm speaking with Christina Fonseca, Fabrice Grinda, and Paul Foster.
You're all super successful unicorn founders turned investors. Fabrice, you founded three successful businesses, one that I particularly love, which is probably OLX, being my first job out of college, not knowing at all what I wanted to do in life. And OLX kind of brought me to the world of tech and to First Minute. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I think it would be more fun if you introduced yourselves in 2-3 minutes before we kick off with questions about your first minute and your last minutes. So, Fabrice, do you want to introduce yourself?
I guess I'm French. I grew up in Nice. I came to the US for college when I was 17, went to Princeton, finished off my class, then knew I wanted to be a tech entrepreneur, but went to McKinsey & Company for a few years as I felt it was like business school, except they pay you. And 22 years ago, I started my first big startup, which was an auction site for Europe and Latin America. I kind of coincidentally did that, started investing, so lived through the bubble on the up and also on the down after it exploded. After the bubble burst, built a mobile content company called Zingy, grew from zero to 200 million in revenues and profitable in 4 years, though in so doing, missed payroll 27 times, borrowed 100,000 of my credit cards, slept on the couch of the office. It was a complex and complicated journey, and then went back to my first true love of marketplaces in 2006 to build OLX, which is now the largest classified site in the world with 5,000 employees in 30 countries and 350 million users a month. And I sold that to Naspers, and in 2013, I'd already made over 100 investments. I'm like, you know what? I like building companies. I like investing in companies. And so I created FJ Labs, which is kind of this hybrid venture fund startup studio where every year we invest in over 100 startups, mostly marketplaces, and we build one or two new marketplaces de novo every year. And that's basically it.
Awesome. Thank you. Christina?
Sure. I mean, Christina Fonseca, first of all, it's really a pleasure to be here. After telling a little bit about my pneumonia story, I think that's one of the reasons why I became an entrepreneur. I was born in a super small village where there's no one my age, where I am right now, in the middle of Portugal. Then I moved to Lisbon to study computer science. And after that, and after this pneumonia experience, I decided I'd better do something with my life that was meaningful and created the impact. And joining a corporate was not really an option. There were no startups at all in Portugal. So I started a journey of exploring this world of internet businesses. Me and my co-founder, Tiago, the person I started Talk Desk with for 1 year, we launched three businesses. We failed. Eventually, Talk Desk came to life. We did a prototype. We participated in a pitch competition in the US. We moved there to join an accelerator. And that was the way we started Talk Desk. I worked super hard for 6 years. And then I decided I needed to design an adult life that was a little bit more sustainable than working like 24/7 pretty much and sleeping sometimes. And then I realized spending time with founders was quite energizing for me. And I decided to start Indico with two other partners. So we are the leading independent VC in Portugal, investing in local founders with global ambitions.
Amazing. Thank you. And we are actually co-investors on a business together.
Yes. And with Fabrice, I think we are going to be very, very soon.
Exactly.
And Paul, you're...
Paul Foster, from the UK originally. and spent 5 years in Southern Africa. Did an MBA in France at INSEAD, and actually I met the Ronnie Kahan, who I co-founded a couple of businesses with subsequently. Went to the US. I spent 3 years working for the International Finance Corporation, which is part of the World Bank Group. And then Ronnie and I started a job site for financial professionals in 1998-99. Went through the dot-com bubble bursting. We built it to a profitable business, bootstrapped it, sold it in 2003, and then started Indeed in 2004, which is a search engine for jobs you may have heard of, and grew that to an exit in 2012. We sold it to a Japanese HR services company. Ronnie actually stayed on as chairman. I moved back to the UK. I'm based in Cambridge now. And the last 6 years I've been doing early stage investing. So I've invested in about about 45, mostly London-based tech companies, fairly early stage. So a mixture of quite a bit of fintech, SaaS, and that keeps me busy. Look, happy to answer questions and participate in this meeting today.
Amazing. Thank you. And we're also co-investors, Paul, with WeVat and maybe one or two other businesses. So before talking about your successes and failures and lessons learned, I would love to hear about the very first minute of your entrepreneurial journey at Indeed, OLX, and Talkdesk. So maybe Christina, we can start with you. So you started Talkdesk almost by accident, if I'm not mistaken. In 2011, you entered a online contest organized by Twilio because you wanted to win a computer, which was the prize of the contest. So to win the contest, you built the prototype and kind of presented the original idea of what Talkdesk would become. You won the contest, you won the computer, that's when VCs kind of started pouring in to give you money to build your idea, which you had never really intended to make a business. So I would love to hear about what happened there.
Yeah. So the story is almost like that. It happened by accident, but I think we were prepared, and that makes all the difference. But what happened was quite simple. So we were super young and naive computer science graduates that wanted to build a company and were already following the Silicon Valley ecosystem, basically because in Portugal, I mean, like no one understood what an entrepreneur was. So everyone around us thought, they are just crazy people. Like, we don't understand. They must be doing nothing. And me and Tiago spent 1 year exploring ideas. Like, we launched 3 internet businesses that, I mean, like, they pay the bills, but were not huge success cases, like not even success cases. But this was a very important process for us to learn. And along the way, like, we went from exploring almost random ideas to finding the Talkdesk problem. And we did that by paying attention to what we were doing when building the other businesses. So in this internet world, we found that every time someone would try to reach out to me, like, I would go and stalk that person in my help desk, in my CRM, which was already in the cloud, in my billing system that was already in the cloud. And we thought, come on, if someone calls me, like, I have all this information in the cloud, but it's not connected. And phones are not in the cloud. So I cannot say, like, hey, Fabrice, how are you? Like, I need to ask you, who are you? Who am I speaking with? Are you a customer? Are you not a customer? So we thought there was an opportunity there, and we participated in this Twilio contest, whose goal was exactly to win a computer. And we were, like, almost desperate because nothing was working. And we said, we think we're going to get the computer. I mean, let's build a prototype. So we built the first prototype. Then we won the contest. We were invited to pitch the idea in a Twilio competition in the U.S., We went there, we were invited to join 500 startups, and in 2 weeks, we came back to Portugal, packed our stuff, and moved to the US. So although it was by accident, I think we were, like, we prepared for it. And we invested a lot of time and effort in learning how to create a web business.
It's still a very fun story. And I'm sure you were prepared. I didn't mean that you wouldn't. And I actually wanted to ask you when you moved to the US to join 500 startups, you've said in a few interviews that, and you also mentioned it in your introductions earlier, that you worked harder to prove yourself in the Silicon Valley, that you, I'm quoting you, but you had an inferiority complex compared to like the Silicon Valley mentality. Can you maybe tell us a bit about that and how it, you know, what was the experience? What were the lessons that you learned?
Yeah. I mean, I think that has to do with the fact that we were like not only European, but Portuguese. And I mean, small country, like quite not super poor, but I mean, like you quite poor in that sense. The way for you to start a business in Portugal would be, I get customers, people pay me, like I have a business. But this notion of creating a global company from Portugal, like didn't exist before. So when you go to the US, first you need to learn a different way of creating businesses, which was not natural for us. So I remember like trying to make sense of this world of investment dynamics. I remember Dave McClure screaming like, who is not raising money in our accelerator meetings? And like, we were pretty much the only ones because we didn't understand that could enable us to go faster and tackle the opportunity and become leaders that way. So there were so many new things. Then we were, of course, very shy. Like English was not our first language. We didn't go to MIT or Stanford. So, I mean, I thought I had so much to learn from this. I remember telling Tiago, okay, this is going to be such an experience. You're going to learn so much. Because we really thought we had to catch up in a way. I mean, like, we realize that engineering schools are as good like as in the US. Maybe they don't have the same reputation, but technically we were at the same level, and we could learn everything else. So that was basically it. But culturally, it was tough to make sense of all of this.
Hard work was very fruitful.
Yeah, I mean, and hardworking wise, because that's another thing. Like people in the US, they say all the time, oh, I'm so busy. I work so hard, you know. And when you listen to these all the time, you really embrace it and you believe that's the way. Mm-hmm. So like, and that's what we did. We just worked every minute.
And Paul, what was your first minute for Indeed in 2004 after having exited from Jobs and the Money?
Well, we had a very lean mindset, having been through the dot-com bubble bursting in 2000 with our previous business. So we were extremely careful with how we spent money. And we raised one round of funding in a year after we started in 2005. So we raised $5 million from Union Square Ventures, New York Times, and Allen & Company. And that we were able to take us to profitability just on that one round. So that was pretty exciting, and I think you know some of the lessons there are just to be really careful with how you spend money and be really disciplined in execution. And then we went through the 2008 crisis, and some of the same lessons came into play there. So, for example, we were very careful with our marketing budget and made sure we only did sort of ROI positive marketing as one example.
That's fascinating. And I definitely want to go back to, you know, the lessons learned from crises and failure right after we talk about Fabrice's founding story of OLX and why did you want to build the Craigslist 3.0? Or I don't know if you would call it anywhere else, but
well, I guess I was an economist by formation, so I always loved marketplaces because I liked bringing liquidity and transparency to opaque and fragmented markets, and it unlocked extraordinary amounts of value. And I'd already done it once with Dedemate and Auckland in the bubble days. And in a way, Zingy was was a company I built out of need or necessity. It's like, okay, in a world where no capital is available, where I need to build something that can be profitable, what can I build? At that time, I think I was 25. So first company, I was like 23. And I felt I could build a ringtone company, even though I didn't actually particularly care for the products I was selling. It's like, I want to be an entrepreneur. I'm willing to do anything to be an entrepreneur. That's an idea I think I can execute with limited capital. So I'm like, okay, now I want to go back to my roots. And I like the idea of helping hundreds of millions of people to actually trade and make money, to find the jobs that they want, to be able to get babysitters so they can have dates with their husbands, et cetera. And in the U.S., Craigslist was starting to come and to become really a force, but frankly, it sucked. It was full of, they didn't moderate content. It was full of prostitution and spam and scam. And frankly, they haven't really improved since. And I was like, you know, I don't know if I can break in a cycle of liquidity and create and given that they already have traction, but let's build a better mobile first product in a time where, by the way, they were not mobile in any way, shape, or form. And because I don't know if I can break in, let's throw a lot of spaghetti in the wall. Let's launch in 100 countries and see where it sticks. And so I was, in a way, I got lucky because the prior company had been really successful. I sold it for like $80 million in cash, and I'd own essentially most of it. And the VCs, I'd refused to fund it. And all of a sudden, we realized that they missed out an opportunity. Every VC was like throwing money at me. And so for this one, I raised $10 million pre-launch on a PowerPoint at a $28 million valuation. So I had actually capital for the first time. And so I was able to spend like $50K in 100 countries, which actually is $5 million, throwing a lot of spaghetti in the wall to see where it would stick. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened, sadly, it didn't work in the US. It did not work in any of the developed world. But of all the places, it worked really, really well in Brazil, in Portugal. Actually, Portugal, it really exploded instantaneously, became our highest penetration country. In India and in Pakistan. So we went from 100 countries down to 4. And then after we won these 4, we re-expanded to 30.
Amazing. And your strategy was to first win the horizontal consumer-to-consumer category of used goods transaction. And then once you won that, you then launched the consumer-to-consumer cars, and which then allowed you to launch the B2C for cars, et cetera.
First of all, the way mostly build marketplaces, you start in the supply because the suppliers are financially motivated to be in the platform. And of all the things you can, you know, if you think of a classified site like Craigslist or OLX, we cover every single possible category. But you want to start, the reason we started focusing on consumer-to-consumer used goods is in many of the countries we're in, the incumbents were not particularly good. Like the eBay wasn't very developed. There was no payments. There was no shipping. And so actually having classifieds made a lot of sense. And being in that category where people transact a lot, you create a brand and you create a user base that's coming to the site multiple times a month, every month. And from there on, it's actually easier to then launch cars and real estate. We didn't really do jobs, to be honest, and services. And I didn't want to go and launch in these verticals first because if you do cars, people will buy a car once every 3, 4, 5 years. And so you don't actually create this flywheel with powerful network effects that you get when the consumer-to-consumer goods category. And from there, we then verticalize the site. And if you look at OLX today in our core countries, like in Russia or in Brazil, we're the leading player in, frankly, every category, like jobs, real estate, services, cars, and goods trading.
Amazing. Thank you. And before, as we're, you know, now probably just at the beginning of what might be a global crisis, before we talk about really like all the successes and all the great things you're doing now, I'd love to dig a bit deeper into the hardships that, you know, you all talked about in the beginning of the conversation, and, you know, your own crises and your own difficult beginnings and the lessons that you've learned from those difficult times. And for instance, Paul, you talked that from Jobs and the Money, you learned to have a lean mindset. You also talked about being careful of how you spend your money, as well as your marketing budget. When you started Indeed, which you co-founded in 2004, you went through the 2000, 2008-2009 crisis, but you came out of it even stronger. So in 2008, Indeed was named the best job hunting site on Job Hunt. And then in 2010, I think you surpassed Monster.com to become the highest traffic job site in the US. How did you do that? And how did you incorporate the lessons learned from Jobs in the Money beyond, you know, the marketing and the
Well, I think that it was a testament, the success and the traffic that the site attracted was a testament to the model, because we were the first really to apply the Google model to classified. So giving job seekers a comprehensive job search experience, we were aggregating jobs from all over the web and including them in our index for free, and basically applying that model that really put the job seeker first. So that was one of the keys. And then in terms of the revenue model also, it was kind of more powerful than the paper listing model, with the auction pay-per-click model, which again was an analogy to the search engines, to Google's AdWords product. And so when we hit the recession in 2008, the fact that our traffic was so high and the pricing model was much more flexible and much more cost-effective than the job board paper listing model enabled us to continue growing and to provide our clients with a more sort of cost-effective candidate acquisition channel. And our projections were 100% growth. I think in 2008, we had to slash that to 30% growth. So we continued to grow, but less quickly than before.
Thank you. Christina, before founding TalkDesk in 2011, you co-founded three companies that ultimately did not have as big a success as TalkDesk. What were the lessons that you learned from those three businesses?
I mean, the first lesson is actually that no one wakes up in the morning and does everything right. So it takes a little bit of persistence. But also, I think, in that journey, we were very realistic with ourselves. And every time we were seeing things were not working, like it was not giving up, but it was incorporating the lessons that we were learning along the way. For example, with our first business, which was a tutoring platform for high school students, we learned that market was very important. We started doing something for Portugal, for a target market that had no money, didn't want to pay, and would only use that in a specific time of their lives, a little bit like the car. So you can't build that stickiness in the product. So we quickly realized, okay, this is not going to meet what we are aiming for. Mm-hmm. So we'd better think about something else. Then we tried to build a super special marketing platform, it was so amazing. But basically, we didn't know shit about online marketing besides a couple of books and reading blog posts all the time because we were trying to promote our solutions online. So the second one, having realized that the platform that we wanted to build already existed, 30 of them, and we didn't even know the correct name, it was such a huge lesson because we had to trash 5 months of work, realizing, well, we better do something that we understand. And then, we built another business, which was an add-on for an Amazon product, pay the bills. We had around 1,000 paying customers, but it was solving a small problem. And we knew that it was a way to pay the bills once we were exploring and trying to find the big idea. But basically this was it. We just kept trying, learning along the way and being very realistic with ourselves. I feel sometimes entrepreneurs, because they make this public commitment of I'm doing X, then they even if they are hitting the wall, they don't give up and then don't iterate fast enough. So because no one around us understood what we were doing, I think we were quite quick to iterate and move on when we felt it was the right time.
So I love it. So basically learn to let go when it's time and be realistic with yourself and do something you understand.
And pick the right market. Pick a market that's big enough and sees the value of what you're building.
And Fabrice, you mentioned especially your experience at Zingy, where before becoming a huge success and flying, you went through dark times, including, I think, missing payroll for 4.5 months in a row. So what happened there? How did you come out of that?
Well, it's interesting how the contrast went from in the bubble days. I was 23. I raised like $63 million in venture money. And it got to the point where it was so frothy. I remember receiving binding signed term sheets from VCs I'd never met before by fax. I mean, that was crazy. I mean, that's really a bubble, by the way. Like, there's nothing that we've loved in the last 20 years that is anywhere near the level of frothiness and bubbliness, except perhaps in the crypto space a few years ago. But in 2001, after the bubble burst, it was the exact opposite. It was like the nuclear winter of startups. Now, the 2001 recession, you know, combined with like 2000 from the tech tech explosion and 9/11, from a macro perspective, is actually rather shallow. It wasn't a very deep recession like the recession of 2008-2009, the one we're about to face right now, which is going to be a lot worse. But from a tech perspective, it was the worst time ever. I mean, I don't think when I started raising money for my second startup, I would call VCs and tell them what I was doing, you know, B2C telecom, when every single B2C company had gone under, every telecom company had gone under. I don't think I'd finished the sentence, they'd hung up. Literally, everything froze. There was no capital available. And so I was like, okay, how do I need to be able to build a business that's going to be profitable? That was the only KPI that mattered. How do I get a profitability as soon as possible with what little money I saved from the bubble days? And sadly, the stock, the company that bought us in the bubble days, fell 99.98%. So my net worth fell from 400 million to 700,000. So I had 700,000. That was basically my seed money. I invested all of it, and then I borrowed 100,000 of my credit cards. But the problem is, eventually, my credit card companies decided they didn't want to be funding my startup, and so I would raise money here and there. If I met anyone, I would like, "Do you want to invest in my startup?" It's like, and I would raise like I raised 1.4 million in 5K increments. It's like 5K here, 10K there. I didn't just miss payroll for 4.5 months in a row. I missed payroll 27 times. But then I would meet someone, give me 10K, and I'd like make payroll. So it was always late, but eventually it took me 2.5 years to reach real profitability. And that was a defining moment. I mean, at that point, that's the very point where we had missed for 4.5 months in a row. And we'd gone from 27 to 7. I started coding again, which I'd done forever. But in so doing, we had laid the foundations of our success in the last 2.5 years. By sheer persistence, grit, and working 100 hours a week, we signed all the operators, we signed all the music licenses, we signed all the artists. So the plumbing was in place for when the market was ready for it. And we had been a bit early, but in this case, it was better to be too early than too late. And then after we signed the first contract with the first operator, which took us 2.5 years, and it really worked, all the other operators, like Lemmings, decided they wanted to sign with us. And so we literally went from, you know, 1 million in revenues from the first 9 months of 2003 to 4 million in the last 3 months, to then 50 million in 2004 and 200 million in 2005. I mean, it became a rocket ship. But the most critical moment was that day when we got the check that allowed us to pay the back pay my credit card debt. And, you know, I'd been literally sleeping on the couch of the office. I was living in New York and $2 a day. I couldn't even afford coffee. Like, I was living off ramen noodles. But you know, you do what you need to do. And like Christina, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was still very young. In a way, when you don't, you overcompensate with work, but you're frugal. And in this case, with grit, tenacity, and persistence, we grab victory from the jaws of defeat.
So what you're saying is really basically get to profitability ASAP is one of the big lessons here. And you have said that the most important moment as an entrepreneur was not when you exited and got, you know, X million in the bank, but actually when you became profitable. And quoting you on an article I read, a podcast.
Oh, for sure. I mean, in that time, because the day we sold, then we were growing like crazy. I was so busy growing the company. It didn't even change my life. I stayed in my little studio apartment for another like 4 years. I think I bought myself a tennis racket and an Xbox. But the day we hit profitability, we were like saved. I was like, you know, deliverance. But that said, look, it depends which stage you're at. If you're big enough to cover profitability, I think right now in this environment, if you're a late stage company, absolutely, you have one KPI, get to profitability. If you're an early stage company, you need to survive. So make sure you have 24 months of runway and you have persistence and staying power, because you're going to be even in a better position coming out of this than you came in coming into it, because your value prop typically and probably just becomes like stronger.
And I love you said, that when you had become profitable, I knew we had become the masters of our own destiny.
Absolutely.
So love that. But so, and you kind of just touched on it, but when as an entrepreneur do you know it's the right moment to maybe stop thinking of growth at all cost and start thinking about profitability?
Well, first of all, you should always think about unit economics. So usually in the first periods of your life of your company, you're not going to cover your fixed costs, but you need to make sure that for each transaction you make, the transaction adds something to the bottom line. And the unit economics that we like, that I like personally with the business I build, is that you recoup your customer acquisition costs on a net contribution margin basis in 6 months. You at least 3x your CAC in 18 months. And ideally, you don't even know what your LTV to CAC is, because you have negative churn. And even though you've lost some of your customers, the remaining ones are buying more and more and more. And so maybe your LTV to CAC is 10 to 1, 20 to 1 or whatever. So always focus on your unit economics, even from the get-go. Like prior to launching a business, I actually think, what would the theoretical unit economics be? Like, what's my average order value? What's the net and what's margins I'm expecting the business? Based on the small tests I did with $100 in Google and Facebook, what is the CPC? And based with expected conversion rates, what can I expect the CAC to be, and can that scale? So unit economics, you should always focus on at all times. Now, in terms of when to spread the, you know, put the pedal of the metal and push on growth versus when to be cash conscious, the problem, of course, and it's a very venture capital answer, is it depends, you know, because you think of like the world we're in right now. Are there companies that should be investing more right now? Probably, like Zoom, or if you're we're in a nurses marketplace that is crushing it. We're in a lot of video game companies or marketplaces that are crushing it. So these should be spending more, and there are others that should be a lot more careful. And so you do need to read the macro tea leaves. You know, if you need to raise money in any time the next 9 months, it's probably a terrible idea unless you have macro tailwinds because of COVID and the business you're in. And therefore, right now, it would be a time to be very, very cautious. I mean, on average, our portfolio companies, the CEOs have stopped paying themselves. They've laid off 15% of their staff, and they've cut salaries by 15% across the board for everyone. This way, we're all in it together, and there's only one KPI that matters, is we survive. So if you're early stage, it's we get 2 years worth of cash. If you're late stage, it's we get a profitability. And that's it. Nothing else matters. And you get rid of like the fair weather entrepreneurs or fair weather journeymen. And you just focus on using this as an experience that we're all in this together, and we're going to make it through the other end.
Got it. Christina and Paul, you also ran profitable businesses. Do you share Fabrice's view? And was becoming profitable the most defining moment for you as a founder? And if not, what was the most defining moment? Christina, see you smiling.
Okay. I mean, when you're in SaaS, I think it's a little bit different than marketplaces. But like, definitely being profitable, like, and that was our assumption from day one. You create a business, people pay you, you make money, you make enough money to pay your expenses. Like, that's the perfect place to be. But actually, like in our case, one of my regrets is not having scaled as fast at the beginning. At some point, we were like we were struggling to like get around the funding and like assemble like a lot of different teams and go faster. And only when we found Jason Lemkin, we got that push So we got investment, and then it was very, very painful. We went from 30 people to 150 in 1 year. So, I mean, I see the advantages of both phases. Like, I wouldn't ever create a business or think about a business without thinking unit economics and how is this going to be a profitable business, because I guess that's the definition of running a business. But sometimes you really need this cash injection to be able to get somewhere. So in our case, like, it was not some, like, it was not a defining moment. Like, I think it was more the other way around. The magic of having extra cash to be able to scale and capture market size. Like, that was when the magic happened for us. Oh gosh, like, we can go way faster.
And by the way, don't get me wrong. I mean, if you're building a venture-based back business, you want to build something big, right? We all want to be building something big. It's as much work to build a restaurant than to build a billion-dollar company. So might as well go and build a billion-dollar company. And I think having external capital makes a lot of sense. Once you know, if you nail it before you scale it, but then, like, absolutely spend and grow and have smart, intelligent people around the table.
Yeah, so for our experience, we definitely, when we raised our round of $5 million, our objective was to get to profitability on that round, and we were able to do that. And so it was a huge achievement for us, and it was what we planned to do. But I agree with the advice that's been given so far. I think that if you can extend your runway, it's a very smart thing to do at this particular point in time. I think that... another aspect is to try and reorientate your strategy to sectors that are still buoyant. So insofar as you can, there is, for example, in recruitment, there are certain sectors that are always going to be hiring, even during the very down, difficult times like the one we're in at the moment. So healthcare, and during the financial crisis, we avoided trying to sell to financial services. So trying to identify those more buoyant sectors, I think, is a good idea to try and weather these situations. And I think another aspect is communications. One of the things that was quite interesting for us, as indeed in 2008, was that Union Square Ventures tried to buy New York Times' stake in Indeed and got quite a long way down the line in doing that. But we released our revised projections halfway through the year, just before this deal was due to close, and they actually ended up pulling the deal and not buying the New York Times' stake. So I think another lesson is communications. It turned out that wasn't a bad situation for us, because we ended up keeping New York Times as an investor. But it does show that frequent communications can change outcomes during these difficult times, whether it's with your employees or your investors, any stakeholder. Keeping open lines of communication is, I think, another lesson perhaps from our perspective.
Yeah, I agree. That's super valuable. And I think we're all feeling the importance of communication in this remote world. So on a more introspective level, across your journeys as founders of several businesses, how did you get better at spotting your strengths and weaknesses? And acknowledging those and bringing, you know, the missing link around you. Paul, do you wanna go?
I think that probably we tried to do too much ourselves, the two co-founders, for too long, and probably could have done with bringing in, partly because of our cost consciousness. We were too tight. We didn't want to bring in expensive C-level execs. But in retrospect, perhaps we should have done that sooner. So bringing in a CFO, bringing in a head of marketing, we eventually did that and took some of the pressure off ourselves. So maybe that's, but it's, you can go too far the other way as well. And if you try and bring in a C-level suite too early before you've established product market fit, that can also be a mistake. So finding the right balance, I think, in the timing of bringing in your key people is important.
Yeah, I agree. Christina?
So, I mean, like, the journey stuff. So I would say, like, for me, what really helped me was spend time with people that were going through the same. that basically along being super self-motivated, which you need to be. I mean, I remember those days where things were like falling, everything was on fire, and still you had to show up like with a your best smile and like be very positive to keep the team going. So like that balance is very important. And then for me, like picking the right investors made like a huge difference. I think we were very lucky. Like we went to Silicon Valley and then like we ended up in the right bubble. But if we were not, I think like things could be completely different. So like I feel really fortunate to have a bunch of people around me, both friends, investors, and people I could share ideas and the struggles and all that to go through this challenging on a personal level, like very, very challenging journey. But I mean, I love it. Like, don't get me wrong. The energy and the motivation you get from making things work, you know, like going through every step, discovering new things, that's amazing. But sometimes it's tough.
Yeah. So this idea of having personal and professional mentors kind of throughout your life.
Yeah. Most of them are going to be not official, like, you know, very, but yes. Definitely.
And what about you, Fabrice?
I think for me, it's on the first startup, I made two fundamental mistakes. The first one is because I didn't particularly care about, and I realized I hated admin work and legal work. I didn't pay that much attention to like the stock purchase agreement, and also I'd never seen one before, being 23 and all. But it's like. And so I didn't negotiate a drag and a piggyback and registration rights and promoter rights, et cetera, which was a huge mistake. But it also let me realize, A, so picking the right lawyers, B, picking the right VCs and VC partners, and C, realizing that I hate all this admin stuff, having a partner to do all that stuff is very fundamental, which led to the second big mistake on recruiting where, in this case, I deferred too much to my VCs and recruited C-level execs that, frankly, were not suited for the business. And so I realized that it was better to have functional experts at the right time, as Paul said, when the business is ready for them, and to have a partner to deal with all the stuff that I hated to do. That's why at OLX, I had a partner, Alec, who dealt with all the admin and operations. And at FJ Labs, at Jose, who manages both LP relationships, but frankly, everything legal and admin. Like, I like deciding whether we invest in a company or build a company, but I don't like anything that everything after that decision, everything that follows, I don't like. And so other than like talking to the entrepreneur. And so it's great to have a partner to help me do that. And I've realized, okay, I should do the things I love to do and I'm meant to be doing and nothing that I hate to do because I'm not going to be doing it very well. I'm just going to, if I read a legal contract, I fall asleep after word three. And so I should not be reading legal contracts. For the first 100 investments I made, the entrepreneur would send me the doc and I would auto sign it without reading it. And that's fine. And by the way, I never got screwed. But I think that's fine when you're investing your own money. I don't think that works when you're investing other people's money. And so I wouldn't have a fund if I didn't have a partner because my willingness and desire to read legal documents is essentially negative. And so have partners. And what's interesting is you start building the relationships with people that you keep working with. I mean, I've been working with my VP of marketing since 1998. You know, it's been 22 years. My CFO has been with me now for like 20 years. And so the people that you love and the core team, you take with them throughout your life. And so you start surrounding yourself by people you love working with.
Awesome. I totally agree. So today you're all unicorn founders turned investors. So I would love to touch a bit about on that transition and why. So maybe Paul, starting with you, you stepped down from Indeed in 2012 and then relocated to Cambridge, became an angel investor, joined the Cambridge Angels. Why angel investing? Why angel investing? Are there any sectors that you particularly like investing in? And then from two questions. From the investor perspective, what are the first lessons that you've learned from angel investing? And then because you see founders from the very beginning, what are the mistakes or the most recurring mistakes that really early stage founders make?
So I have invested in 45 companies, a lot of fintech, so application layer, a lot of business-to-business SaaS companies, mostly London-based. I haven't done a huge amount of deep tech, although beginning to dip my feet in the water there. And in terms of lessons, I think when I first started, the biggest mistake I made was projecting. Having been a founder exec in the past, it's very easy to project. So you see an opportunity and you say, wow, that is such a great opportunity. That's such a good idea. If I was running that business, I would absolutely kill it. And you forget that you're not running it. You're not going to be running it. It's the entrepreneurs, the founders who are going to be running it. So you need to be, it's a very different mindset. As a exec, you're kind of constantly thinking, well, how am I going to execute this opportunity? As an investor, it's how are other people going to execute? And therefore, it's all about evaluating the team. And the earlier the stage is, the more it's about the team. To some extent, the opportunity as well, but it's kind of team. And there's kind of no track record to judge. There are very few metrics. And so that's the easy mistake, is just to project. And that took me about maybe 2 or 3 years to learn that lesson. Now I think I'm better at it. So it's about the team. So it's pretty exciting. I've started to dip my toe in the water of some deep tech in health opportunities in Cambridge. I just made my first sort of pharma-related investment in the sort of intersection of digital and pharma, which I think is a exciting new area. Did I answer all your questions? There might have been another one.
Yes, I think you did. Thank you. And Christina, when you exited TalkDesk in 2016, you traveled for a year, which we actually didn't talk about, and I'd love to if we have a bit more time at the end. But then in 2017, you co-founded Indigo Capital Partners, which is the first, I think, venture fund in Portugal, where you're currently a venture partner. And in addition to being an investor for early stage businesses, you're also the youngest board member of a listed company in Portugal called Galp, which is in the oil and gas space. So how do you balance and adapt from, the super early scrappy companies and entrepreneurs to the public ones? And how do you put this serious hat on with people double your age?
Great question. It's actually quite funny. I see that as like playing different personas. And I think like I bring, because I'm exposed to so many different realities, like I can bring a very different perspective. And I think that's the way I had value. Spending time with scrappy entrepreneurs that have a little bit more than a blank sheet of paper, to like not trying to do their work, which sometimes is challenging if you are transitioning from a founder to an investor, to like going to these boards where like people are at double your age, most of them, and really had value and try to transport these companies to a reality that's very, very different than it was 20 years ago. It's very fun, but it takes a lot of work, of course.
And you, Fabrice, you've been a super angel for forever, as well as institutional investor through FJ Labs, and you've invested in more than 600 startups, I think. What makes something that you would not invest in, absolutely would not invest in?
I'm very heuristics driven when it comes to investing. And actually I decide essentially 1 hour if I invest or not in a startup. And I have four key heuristics. Like, do I like the team? Do I like the business? Do I like the deal terms? And does it meet my thesis on where the world is heading? And all four of those things essentially have to be true for me to invest. And so any of these four if any of these four is not met, I don't invest. That said, it's a bit vague from a terminology perspective, so I'll clarify it. But like, what is a great founder? Because every VC or interim investor will tell you, I invest in amazing teams, but like, what's an amazing team? For me, it's a team where they're amazing storytellers, This way they can raise better money, attract more talent, get better BD deals, get more PR, and they're numbers driven. This way they're analytical, they know their unit economics, and they're going to build a profitable business. Because if you have either of those things without the other, you may raise a lot of money and not build a very profitable business, or you may have an operations machine that can't raise any money. And so the Venn diagram between these two things is not very great. Number two, a company that has great unit economics, and I talked a bit earlier about what I think great unit economics are. And number three, reasonable deal terms. And there's in the back of my mind, especially in marketplaces, I have this pattern recognition of what I think the right GMV and take rate and net revenue level is for what level of valuation. Actually, I wrote a blog post on that. It has to be reasonable. I don't like overpaying because I know ultimately you typically get mean reversion. And then last but not least, I have three current theses I'm investing in when it comes to marketplaces in terms of the verticalization of horizontal platforms, the redesigning of marketplaces where the marketplace picks the supplier, and B2B marketplaces, and is the company meeting that trend and thesis. And so if you meet all four, I invest, and if you don't meet it, but it is all four required. If you don't meet one of them, I won't invest. You may be an amazing team, but I don't like your unit economics, I won't invest. Or if you're too expensive, I won't invest.
Okay, got you. On that note, we're a bit out of time, but thank you so much. It was so much fun to speak with the three of you, Fabrice, Paul, and Christina. Thank you.
Thank you, Camilla. My great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you for having us.